Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot brought to you from Eretz HaKodesh is daf Yudchet, and we got up to the top of the daf right after the words B'kishat Chayrum Domu, and we could continue on with the Velisne. Just, however, to position ourselves properly over here, let us understand that a Ketuvah, as we've explained it, is meant to be an assurance of all kinds of things that have to do with marriage, primarily that the marriage is going to not be casual, and that at the same time, there is a sense of stability as well in the partners to the marriage. Now, we've started with the issues of the fact that shakdu, and we're going to see that this is a balance because we need for men to want to get married as well. And as we'll see, one of the issues about the ketuvah and a woman feeling secure with the ketuvah is the ease of collection. And it's because of that, that fascinatingly, the dinim of the ketuvah continue to change even after the time of the Gemara. So that normally when we have a contract, the contract enables someone who's got a lien against somebody else to collect from real property. Does not allow them to collect from metaltalin. Now, there came a point in history where Jews, in many places, were not allowed to own real property, so that we then changed the nusach of the ketuvah. The nusach of the ketuvah now reads, afilu miglima dal katpai. You can collect even from the shirt off of my back. That is in order for women to feel secure that there is going to be a way for them to collect the ketuvah, even if there's no real property to collect from. Because of that, we're going to see further examples of this later in the Masechet, the ease of collection that we need to define in order to make a woman feel secure also forces us to consider what type of tainas will be believed in a court case and where is there ne'amonis on the part of an isha that she did not collect her ksuva yet or that her ksuva was X amount as opposed to the Baal's taina that it was Y amount and so on. Because of that, Masechet Ketuvot has turned into a repository of all of the dinim that we find across Shas about ne'emanut in collections, including these issues of migu and apesha asar and so on. It's because of that that the Gemara here is so interested in why it would be that the Mishnayos in Ketuvot take cases that are comparatively complex when we could be dealing with very straightforward cases. And that's what we're in the middle of talking about now. We wanted to bring out the idea that according to Rabbi Yoshua, even though in the previous parak we had a lot of discussions about, he says, Lomi Pia Anuchayin, and that Lomi Pia Anuchayin is in a sense a slap in the face to the very idea of Iksuva. Because the more that a woman hears Lomi Pia Anuchayin, the less interested she is in getting married. Because, I mean, I don't know what they're going to say next, that they don't believe me about this, they don't believe me about that, and what happens if something happens to my ksuva, and so on and so forth. So, therefore, we also began over here to explain the difference, even our Liber Rabbi Yoshua, between Migo and between the power of a Pesha Asar or a Pesha Hitir, and that in those cases he would be mated to Rabbi Gamliel, that we would not say Lomi Pia Anu Chayin. So we want to bring out, not necessarily in the context of Ketubah, but in the simplest way possible, where indeed would Rabbi Yoshua be made that Peshas or Pesha Yeter is more powerful than the standard Migo we've been talking about. So the case that we came up with in the Mishnah seems to be a complicated case. And since we're looking for a stripped-down version of the way in which we can understand Pesha Asra Pesha Yitir, the moment that you bring daddy into the picture, which is what the Mishnah did, you're complicating the question. Because then we got to start talking about the issues of Chazaka, and we're talking about a field, and this is crazy. We could have stripped it down much further. Okay, so first we looked to strip it down in terms of keeping the case the same, a real estate case. So the Gemara said there's no way that you could strip that down further because then you'll get into either the question that it's pashut, that of course a person wouldn't be ne'eman under such circumstances. Why would the Mishnah have to tell us if we cannot establish a chazaka? So we talked about the case where the guy ran away and so on and so forth. That was the last thing. So now the Gemara says, okay, why do we need to talk about real estate at all? Which is what got us into that complexity, right? We said, we'd rather not talk about a father. Okay, thanks. We said, there's no choice. You have to talk about a father, even though it complicates matters. Because how else are you going to get a case where it's not an obvious issue of do you or do you not have a chazaka? So we answered that. So now the Gemara says, but why did we need to talk about real estate? Why did you complicate things? It's very, very simple. All we need to do is say that Rabbi Yoshua is Maida, that if a guy goes over to someone and he says, forget about your father. I borrowed $100 from you. I owe you that $100 and I paid you back. What's the problem? So there we have a case of a Pesha. So the guy is admitting that he owes money. And there Rabbi Yeshua says, oh, okay, so I'm certainly going to be Maida in a case like that because I didn't have to say that I owed you money in the first place. So that's a Pesha, so Peshiter. I mean, you realize what you've put us through for the past two dafim because you wouldn't discuss a case, a simple case, and we had to get into all of this rigmarole. I don't understand why. Says the Gemara, I'll tell you why. Because then when you get to the Sefer of the Mishnah, remember, we're trying to contrast the Pesha Asar with, and what would have been if there were witnesses, and then you would not have been Naaman. So what would it have needed to say at the end of the Mishnah if we would have stripped it down? Okay, it would have said as follows. On the other hand, if you've got witnesses, and then he would claim I paid you back, then he's not believed. I got news for you. He is believed. So, I mean, the whole case is ridiculous. We're trying to show why a Pesha Asar is so powerful. Baruch Avram, hello. We're trying to show why a Pesha Asar is so powerful. And what are we going to do? We're going to bring a case where he would have believed anyway without the Pesha Asar. Obviously, we can't have a case like that because there's no need for the Pesha Asar. Because HaKayim Alan, we end up paskening that Hamalvet Chaveiro, even if it's with witnesses. So let's say somebody wants to borrow money. And you say, I don't lend money out without witnesses. Okay, so fine. So you collect two witnesses, you lend the money in front of them. So there's a big machlokas. Does that necessarily mean that in my insisting on witnesses, I am essentially telling you, I don't engage in these type of financial transactions. I'm trusting any memory or anything. It's all got to be done on the basis of witnesses. So then that would imply that I insist that if you pay me back, it's got to be in front of witnesses. I don't want to get into a situation. I don't remember what I'm going to tell you. You want to pay me back, make sure that you pay me back with Adam. There is such a shita. However, we end up saying that we don't paskin like that. And we say that Hamalvet Chaveiro, even though he insists on having witnesses, ain't a tzarech lefaro be'edim. Unless the man specifies that I'm not accepting any money from you except in front of witnesses, he would not have to pay him back. And therefore, if the guy claims I paid you back, so how can you prove that he didn't pay you back? The witnesses that you have that the money was lent don't prove anything. So therefore, we don't need the Pesha Asar, and all Mishnah falls to pieces. The contrast falls to pieces. Okay, fine. That's true. I understand. But you know what? We could have avoided all of the problems, not of the father's involvement, but of real estate involvement. And real estate involvement was just dragged us through the mud with chazaka and everything. Why didn't we just take a simple case? That Maida Rabbi Yoshua, somebody comes and tells someone that, look, you know, your father lent me money, and I paid him back. I paid him back half of it. So they're over there, he should be Naaman without needing to take a shvua Maida v'miksas. And that would show that Rabbi Yoshua is Maida with the case of a Pesha Asar. Fantastic. Without getting into the chazaka issues. Now, well, wait a minute. That's not so pashut. Because Aliba de Man, you see the Gemara is managing, again, remember, this is the typical way that the Gemara is created. It pretends to be dealing with problems in which each one of those problems forces you to take into consideration elements of the sugya that you had previously ignored. So what we're really trying to do is to bring out the functionality of a Pesha Asar or Pesha Yiter in cases of tainas of various types, questions of chazaka, questions of a tzorach of a shvua of meida b'miktzatz, and other issues that we're going to be bringing up, as we'll see. Unbelievably complex issues, including all of the elements of shtoreis, eduyos, kivan shigetshuv v'nechozru magid, einad ameisim atzmei rasha, etc., etc., all within the supposed requirements that we feel that we need to figure out where do we rely on a simple taina that a woman could have against her husband. So this is an incredibly rich sugya in which nowhere else do we find all of these sugyas being stripped down in front of us so that we can actually take into consideration every last issue. So why don't we talk about Rabbi Yehoshua being made at that if he's a made of a miktzah, so to speak, but nobody was ever a toveya, that the pesha asar wa pesha yiter would cancel the chiyuv of a shvuah of made of a miktzah. Remember that if somebody admits that he's paid back half of a loan or half of money that's owed, the din is over there that he is believed only with a shvuah d'oraisa, and the boda makes his betaina. But if it would be a pesha asar wa pesha yiter, where the guy never even sued him for the money, and the guy's coming along and telling him, listen, you know, I need to tell you, I did borrow money from your father, that in that case, we do not require a shvua because of Peshas or Apishayiter. However, the problem is, do we really need a Peshas or Apishayiter? Or, now here's a fascinating issue. The earliest record of a Good Samaritan law is a Mishnah in Gittin. The Mishnah in Gittin says that the Rabbanan made a takana, that somebody who comes and presents a wallet and says, here, I found your wallet, it's got your license in it. And the guy opens up on the wallet and says, yeah, but I had $500 in the wallet and now there's only $300. What happened to the rest of the wallet, the rest of the money? That the guy says, this is all the money there was. So then he's a motive of miktzatz, right? They should have to swear. The Rabbanan made a takana. Nobody who is doing the right thing ever has to swear. Even though normally it's a law of nature that no good deed goes unpunished, comes along the Maseches Gittin and creates a takana not to punish good deeds. Okay. So then the question is whether we need, in this case, do we need a pesha asar or a pesha yiter? Or can we rely on the Good Samaritan laws? That's the question. So I'll leave it to mine. If you're going to tell me that we're going, I'll leave it to Rabbanan. The Rabbanan say that if somebody is made to a taina of, even a taina, not a case over where the guy just comes forward and says, oh, by the way, I owe money to your father. No. Somebody comes over and says, my father lent you money. So then a father is different. And over there, he's considered to be a Meshiva Veda because he did not need to admit anything over there. We'll see the psychological milieu that this takes place in a moment. So then what are you telling me, that it's only because of a Pesha Asar? It's not only because of a Pesha Asar. Pesha Asar would only apply when nobody ever mentioned it until you came along and told me. But the halacha over here would be that a Meshiv Aveda, if you hold that that type of Hodah is a Meshiv Aveda, so then I don't need a Pesha Asar. And on the other hand, if you hold, like Rabbi Yezer ben Yaakov, who says, we're going to be analyzing all of this in a moment, who says that even where a person is made that he owed money without there being any real Tviah in Bez, there's no legal claim, that that person actually does need a shvuah, so then it wouldn't be true. So what are you asking me? How can I say a Mishnah to tell me, well, we keep it simple, Rabbi Yeshua agrees that if he's made it to a debt owed to a father, that that's a peshas, it's not a peshas. Either it's nothing, and you do have to actually make the shvuah, or it's a meshiva veda, and is covered by other laws besides peshas. Let me just bring you up to date on this, says the Gemara de Tanya. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, you know, sometimes a person might have to take a Meida b'miktzat shvua based on his own claim against himself. What? Kate said, well, I'll tell you. A kid comes along, you know, and a guy says to him, oh, you know, your father died, but I want you to know that I owed him money, and I paid him back half of it. Incredibly, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says, well, you're going to have to swear about the other half. And this is considered to be a nishba al ta'anat atzmo, because he's a moda b'miktas. We're going to explain what the case is, why it's called al ta'anat atzmo. But, I mean, what we're assuming is that the child would not have known anything, and he therefore is only chayev because he said he's chayev, which is a problem, because what about the takana of Meshiva Veda? We'll get to all of this. Now, the Chachamim say, no, this is a classic case of Meshiva Veda, which is covered by Good Samaritan laws. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, Vletle, Meshiva Veda, but that's crazy. I mean, if you take it on face value, you're telling me that Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, what, he disagrees with the Mishnah and Gittin? I mean, that's not reasonable. So why, in fact, doesn't he say that the guy should not have to swear? Omar Rav, well, of course, the way that he said it was a little bit misleading. I mean, it can't be that nobody would have known unless the guy tells the kid, I'm sorry to hear of your father's death, and I know that I owe your father money. I mean, of course, that's Meshiva Veda. The case must be that the child says, I know you owe money to my father, and I want you to pay it back. And then the guy says that I paid back half of it. So over there, since the cotton was the one who went to try to get the money back, so it's not Mamish Meshiva Veda. Wait a minute. The din over there is that you don't have to respond to the tain of a katan at all. And therefore, what does that matter? The din is that there never is a shvuah that is taken based on the tain of katan. And if you're telling me that if the guy had said it himself, he would have been a Meshiva Veda, then how could he become chayiv to make a shvuah, which would be a shvuah based on the tain of a katan? It says beferish in a Mishnah. This is a Mishnah in Shavuot. So what happens in a Mishnah now? So that can't be the case. No, 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 no. When we say a cotton, we don't mean a cotton, we mean a gadol. Oh, really? That's a nice way of explaining things. A cotton means a gadol. Yes, but there's a meaning to calling him a cotton. Because the point that we're making here is that whenever, even if this guy, I don't care if the guy is 40 years old, you go over to him and you say, I'm so sorry to hear of your father's death, you know? And then the guy says, my father lent you money, didn't he? But a gadol in the issues that involve his father is the equivalent of a katan. That's what we're saying by definition. An orphan is a katan because he doesn't really know what's going on. Therefore, his taina only has the legal validity of the cotton, and I don't really need to respond. And so, therefore, it's considered to be, according to Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, even so, it's considered to be chashuv enough that I do have to swear, and it's not a Meshiva Veda. Okay, but if that's the case, why did Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov say, al ta'anat atzmo? Come on. This is not ta'anat atzmo. This is a 40-year-old guy comes over to him, says to him, you owe me money because you borrowed money from my father. That's called a ta'anat atzmo. That can't be the case. That's a ta'anat achirim. Yes, it is, but it's a ta'anat achirim. But since over here he was the one that was moda and didn't need to be moda, what are you talking about? Every moda is a moda. Isn't moda of a moda b'miktas? Isn't it always like that? Somebody comes over, says you owe me money, and you say, I only owe you part of the money. Isn't that hodat atzmo? I mean, surely you must admit that it's a very strange way to talk about a special case of moda b'miktas. There are times when you're going to swear on your own taina because you were the one who was moda. Thank you very much. Kuli ta'anata. Every single case of moda b'miktas is by definition a ta'anat achirim v'hodat atzmo. So why are you looking this as a different case? Okay. Let's start at the top, says the Gemara. I'm talking about a katan. I really mean a katan. I like that approach, okay? So you're saying, but a nishpoinat ta'anat katan, right? But that is not really true. Because Enish Boin Al Ta'anat Katan is based on the Gemara over there in Shavuos as analyzing the pasuk. Ki yitain ish el re'ehu. The whole din of Moedah B'miktzas, where it says over there he has to be Nishba, El Elohim, is said only where an ish gave to another ish el re'ehu. That excludes a katan. It doesn't exclude the taina of a katan. It excludes the transaction of a katan. In this case, the father was the one who lent the money. He was ish el re'ehu. Now the katan is coming to ask for a return of the money that was incurred by an ish el re'ehu. Where did the Torah ever say that ein nishboin al ta'anat katan because of ish el re'ehu? That's not true. That means that in this case, even though it was a katan that was to'ein, nonetheless, you are going to have to look at that taina. So what then is the machlokes between Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov and the Chachomim as to whether this is considered to be Hashavas Aveda or not? I'll tell you what the machlokes is. The machlokes is a study in psychology. We're actually arguing in the logical basis for Moedah B'miktzas HaTaina Yishava. And we're talking about the famous analysis that Rabbah made about Mipnei Ma Amra Torah Moedah B'miktzas HaTaina Yishava. This entire idea that we've just had about Meshiva Veda opens up a can of worms, a very powerful can of worms. Because if the Torah says that a Moedah B'miktzas HaTaina, in which you did not need to say anything, you didn't need to admit to anything, you went ahead and you admitted half, if the idea of the good Samaritan, so to speak, I say that, of course, always with a snicker, but if there is really such a concept, then how did the Torah create a chiyuv to be nishba on a Moedah B'miktzas? Now, you see how this was triggered directly by the conversation we just had. Because what we told Rabbi Eliezer is, well, every Moedah B'miktzas is nishbon al ta'anat atzmo, by the way you just said it, right? Oh, gosh, we think to ourselves, that's true. So then, isn't the very din of Moedah B'miktzas, isn't that the most powerful proof that we are wrong in making that kind of law? So I don't understand. How exactly are the Chachamim going to be mechalik between the Torah's willfully ignoring the fact that the guy didn't have to be Meida at all, and instead is Mechayev, and the only time that he's really going to be Chayev Kimat, and a Shvua D'Oraisa based on a Taina? What in the world is going on? Why is that? This is why the Gemara now needs to establish what the basis of that is, and therefore why it is that we look, in this case, to a difference between Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov in the case where it was a katan, which is amazing. And this is the basis of Rabbah. Rabbah says like this, look, we are dealing with a fascinating issue. We don't trust the guy. Obviously, the Torah is saying, I don't trust him. He's got to be nishba. So if we don't trust him, why did he admit it? And if, in fact, you say he admitted it because he wanted to make himself look believable or whatever, so then that means we believe that he's ready to do all of this in order to steal another person's money. So what good is telling him to make a shvua if he's chashud on stealing, then he's chashud on the shvua about the stealing? So and what is this all about exactly? Now, this is very important in understanding how a shvua has any meaning bichlal in circumstances like this, if a guy we don't trust. And furthermore, see, normally we would say the shvua that we have relates to something else. Let's say the guy claims that something was stolen and that he had watched it perfectly well. And you had given him something to watch. And then we make him take a shvua, shalo shalach yado b'melechet re'eo. Okay, so swear that you never took his watch to look at and see what the time is. Well, now that's a whole different issue. I mean, well, the truth is I did once need to look at the time and I didn't have my watch. Okay, fine. So then you pay. I understand that over there, of course, it makes perfectly good sense to put a shvua. But if you're putting a shvua on the very thing that the guy is ready to lie about and steal, what exactly is the functionality of that shvua? And furthermore, why indeed don't we view this as like a classic moda b'miktzas? And what's the logic? So therefore, comes along Rabbah and says, we're dealing with a very delicate balance. Because on the one hand, chazoka, ein adam me'iz panav b'fnei ba'al chovo. What you're not taking into consideration is that this is not really Meshiv Aveda. Why? Because, and here is a very important understanding of the difference between Meshiv Aveda. It turns out there are three dargas. There's the Meshiv Aveda, which we said makes it unnecessary to even invoke HaPesha Asaru HaPesha Yitir. So the Meshiv Aveda is where there would be no reason at all for you to have given this back. Fine. The case of a pesha asar, hu a pesha yitir, is where it's not truly a meshiv aveda, but where we believe you because of a glorified migo, perhaps, according to some rishonim, or because of a different concept of, well, since we need to listen to you, so we have to hear everything that you have to say. Fine. These are complicated sugyas, but it's not the same as being just the Meshiv Aveda and doing the right thing and therefore being subject to this takona of Meshiv Aveda. Then we have every Pesha Asra, Pesha Hiter, is predicated on Ein Shor Shachut Lefanecha. Remember that Gemara before. Ein Shor Shachut Lefanecha means that there was nothing that was mechayev you in any way to need to respond to this. So there was no tfiyah. Fine. There is where we said that we would say, even Alibet Rabbi Yeshua, the idea of HaPesha Asar, Hu HaPesha Hitir. Problem is, says Rabbah, that this is a different situation. Because the fact that there is no real Taina, okay, that's true, but it basically does not mean Ein Shor Shachut, the guy is coming and demanding his money. So it's definitely not a Pesha Asar HaPesha Yitir. So now you want to tell me, okay, but he didn't have to say anything. He could have denied the whole thing. So he's giving you a gift. He's not giving me a gift. Why? Because Chazaka Ein Adam Meiz Panav Bifnei Baal Chovo. Psychologically, he cannot handle a straight out denial face to face with the person who lent him money. The guy did him a favor. And for him to say to his face, you never lent me any money, is not considered to be a psychologically viable response. Therefore, we do not view it as Meshiv Aveda. Meshiv Aveda is where there were no constraints. Over here, there are very powerful constraints. I don't care that they're not legal constraints, but the point is that they are practical constraints. And we base, therefore, your response on normative psychological responses. Okay. Now, the truth is, therefore, that one way of looking at what he's doing, says Rabbah, is that the guy simply does not have the guts to give a complete denial. So therefore, he says the most that he can say. Oh, yeah, thank you so much. You did lend me that money. But, you know, you remember I paid you back half. No, I don't remember. Yeah, I'm sure I paid you back half. So in that case, he overcomes his psychological constraints. Because he's just making it look like he forgot, you know, and he thinks that he paid him back. So therefore, the truth is, if it wouldn't be for the psychological constraints, he would have walked away and not paid a penny. So the only reason that he's not kofer bakol is because of the psychological problem of ein adam meiz panav. That's the point. So because of that, he has to take a shvua. But so then you'll tell me, but one second, Rabbah, so you're admitting that this guy is actually wants to steal money? So now why does the shvua help? How does the shvua help? If he's ready, you say he knows what he's doing and he's not going to pay the guy back, then what's the point of the shvua? Well, says Rabbah, that's not the only issue. The other issue is, of course, the way that he works this out in his head. So there's also the justification and what he sees himself as doing. Now, there's another way of looking at it. The truth is, of course, I would love to pay the guy back. The problem is I don't have any money. So, of course, I intend to pay him back. So next year I'll be able to pay him back when I get that raise. So what I'll do is I'll basically put them off. Because if I don't put them off, then they're going to come in and take away my TV set. That would be a disaster. Then I won't survive the year to be able to get my raise. So I would love to be an honest guy and tell him, yes, I do owe you that money, but I can't afford to do that. So the only reason I don't is I'm trying to get away from the court. But I say to myself, of course I will ultimately pay him. So therefore, we need to look at not only the constraints upon his taina, but we also need to look at the issues of how it is that a person goes through the self-justification process of saying something that is not true. And therefore, the Torah says, okay, let's put the screws on him so that he ends up needing to take a shvuah if he does it that way, because then that would be enough to push him in the right direction, which he really wants to go into. And he would like to be made. Well, this will make him think about that a little more. That's the point. Now, being as this is involved in a delicate psychological dance in understanding this person, then we understand the machlokas Reb Eliezer ben Yaakov, okay? So Reb Eliezer ben Yaakov holds that this constraint of not denying something right to a guy's face who did you a favor extends even to his child. You will not be able to bring yourself to take the child of this guy who died, and he says to you, didn't my father lend you money, and just straight out say to him, nah, never happened. So you have to say something. So that means that this is not a Meshiv Aveda. So we're back now in the context of Motiv Mikzatz. So Loshon above, Loshon of Beno, Eino Meiz. Therefore, don't give me the Meshiv Aveda jazz, okay? So in which case, he is going to need to be a normal Meida B'mikzas, and I'll have to be Nishba. The Rabbanan say, no, the problem that he has psychologically is only strong enough to the guy's face, not to his son. I understand there are obviously a certain amount of conscience pangs, but not enough to say that Eino Meiz. And since in this case, he did not Meiz, even though he could have, so he's considered to be a Meshiv Aveda, and therefore he is Potter from the Shvuah. So therefore what we're talking about is either a case of Meshiv Aveda and not a case of the Meida because of a Peshazar Peshiyatir, or the exact opposite. According to Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, not is he not a Meshiv Aveda, he is basically, in the case where it's a Katan, he's basically going to need to swear, even though he is the one that brought the claim against himself, so to speak. Chaim l'chaim kayin. And we are ready for our most wonderful and special Kapitan. Have you made Avdolah yet? That's the question.
It's getting earlier and earlier. It went down 50 minutes from the previous week. It's now just above 12.
Oh, my gosh. Soon you're going to just be like the rest of us, and you'll have to come home.
Yeah, it's a bit...
Okay, very good. Anyway, this is a bad sign. A sign that summer's coming to an end. So now we're going to extend our issue of Apesha Osar, Apesha Hitir, into another area which will also allow us to explore elements of Edus. And that is the question of Kivan Shigid Shuvenu Choser Umagid, Pagina Nedusai, Ein Adam Meisim Et Hatzmo Rasha, what the din is of a testimony that is Bichtav, as opposed to testimony that is Baal Peh, and so on and so forth. And since all of this also gets into the issue of shtarot in general and collection in general, we continue our search for making clear that all of the fundamental principles of being able to be geiva and to utilize a shtar to be goyva, and particularly to utilize a k'tanai d'rabbanan where you may not even have a shtar to be goyva, we need to go through all of these issues. So now, suppose somebody brings a shtar to Beis Din. Now, as you know, we don't simply look at a shtar as being a proof of collection. We first need to make sure that we're mekayim the shtar. The mekayim the shtar is called a henpek, in which the court is going to stamp the shtar as having been authenticated. How do we authenticate a shtar? Well, the best way to authenticate a shtar is to locate the supposed people who are signed on the shtar and get them to confirm that this is their signature and that they did sign the shtar and that it's not a forgery. So it's an authenticated shtar, will immediately authenticate with a hand. The other way is to find someone who claims to know that this is their signature, so you can identify them. The third way is through handwriting analysis, where we find another shtar that has a henpek on it, that has already been authenticated, and then that's a kosher shtar. So what we want to talk about over here is where we did it the best way. We have the Edim themselves that are coming to confirm that this is a shtar that they signed. But when they say that to us, yes, indeed, k'tav yadenu huzeh, but don't take this shtar seriously. Piece of garbage. Why? Because anusim ayinu, we were forced to sign this. Or we were k'tanim ayinu, we weren't even bar mitzvah yet. Or we were psulei edut ayinu, maybe they're saying they were related, and therefore we're not kosher witnesses. We'll see whether this includes, as Rashi says, at this stage the Gemara assumes, that we were psulei edus because of the fact that we make our living off of playing poker. But whatever. So it's a question whether that's going to be included as well. But, so then they're Naaman. Why are they Naaman? Because of Peshazra Peshiyitir, so to speak. Obviously, it's not the same as the other Peshazra in terms of collection or non-collection, but it means that once someone says something, then we are defined by everything that he says and not just part of it. But on the other hand, if we can confirm that it's their signature because other people are available to authenticate it, or we have another shtar that was authenticated that we could compare it with handwriting analysis, so then we don't need them. And if we don't need them, then there's no din of a peshazra peshiyitir. So again, the Mishnah is contrasting at the end what happens if we wouldn't have had the peshazra in order to make it clear what it is that we're relying on for this Pesha Asa. Now, Omar Rami Bar Chama, let's get one thing straight. If these witnesses claim that they signed falsely because of the fact that the guy that they were testifying for, that he could collect, because they owe him a lot of money, and he said, well, if you don't testify that this guy owes me money, then you is going to be in court, and you is going to lose everything you own, all right? So I'd advise you to sign. So if that's what they say, then we will not accept them. And that when do we say at the end of the Mishnah? This is the way we understand it now. It's going at the end of the Mishnah. That if we have other witnesses, and these guys say we were anusim achmas mama, then they're not believed. But if they give us new information and they say, hey, this guy had a gun to our head and that's why we signed, then I would believe them even if we have independent confirmation of their signatures because they're telling us what the facts are about their own testimony. Why wouldn't we believe them? Amarle Rava, what do you mean, why wouldn't we believe them? We never believe witnesses who say anything about their testimony. You know that. The Torah says, im lo yagid. There's only one chance to say, okay? You don't have chances to go back and revise your testimony. That's a fundamental din in Edus, that the Torah gave you the right to be made, and that's it. Now we're talking about non-Edus, changing Edus. Forget it, baby. You're not a witness anymore. So therefore, Kol Kamine, what, he can change the facts? Where Kivan Shigit, Shuvein Ochozer Omagid, I don't care whether he's got a Peshas or whatever the heck he's got. L'chora, in this case, you're telling me We can't believe him. What about the din of Kim Shigen Shemene Chosru Magid? So now here we don't have a Peshasa. Whether we would say this even against the Peshasa, that we'll see in a minute. So that cannot be true. Unless you want to claim that the din of Kivan Shigid Shuvena Chosru Magid is said on Higid. Higid im lo Yagid. Yagid means to say it over by your mouth. So maybe you'll say a contract is not the equivalent of testimony by mouth. And therefore, maybe over there, now that you're coming forward and you want to tell us with your mouth what the testimony really was, maybe we don't apply the rule of Kivan Shigid Shuvena Chosru Magid. Reb Barnea, you're concentrating too much, which means you're asleep. Reb Barnea, beep, beep, beep. You are concentrating so much, it's clear that you are fast asleep. Oh, my gosh. Calling all Kohanim Gedolim.
I think his screen's frozen.
Oh, maybe that's it. Because if not, it would be a classic, a classic Barnea warp. Okay, we're accepting that you're there, or that you're totally gone. In any event, maybe that's what you'll say. So maybe you'll try to tell me that Hani Milei Alpeh. We only say Kimajigi Shemana Chosru Magid if you're changing your mind verbally. But you could certainly define a document, right? No, that's not true. Because the Omer Reish Lakish, Eidim HaChatumim Al HaShtar, Nasa Kimishinechro Edutan BeBeitin. The law is that a shtar is the full equivalent of an in-person testimony that has already gone through Drisha V'Chakira. That's how shtaros work. So therefore, Rami Bar Choma makes no sense, okay? If Rami Bar Choma said this, he was not referring to the case where we had independent corroboration of the witness's signature. He must have been referring back to the Reisha, and he was saying the opposite. He was saying like this. Eleki Itmar Reisha Itmar. He was saying that if they say, yes, it is our signature, but we were forced, he was saying it in the opposite direction. He's saying, that's only if they say, we were forced because they had a gun to our head. But if they say, we were forced because we were threatened by immense financial loss, if we wouldn't have signed on this, they are not believed. Why? That's a different issue. Because we have a klal that ein adam meisim et atzmo rasha. A person cannot say something that is self-incriminating. So since over here what they're coming to do is essentially give testimony by being Mekayim their Edus, what we need to apply here is the principle of Palginan Dibure. Palginan Dibure means we will believe you insofar as you are an accepted witness. However, since over here one of the people that you're testifying against is yourself, and you're claiming that you are a Rasha, a person cannot bring testimony against himself. Therefore, that part of your statement was not heard by the court because it's irrelevant. The din of Edus is defined by the Torah. There you're not an aid, and as far as we're concerned, you're not saying anything. Now, say again, what did you say? This is your signature. Yes, it's my signature, but shut up. This is your signature. Thank you. That's what I heard. So in that case, says Rami Bar Choma, then we will accept only that part of it, because otherwise, in order to make him atzma rasha. Tana Rabbanan, ein ne'emanim leposlo, divrei Rabbi Meir, v'chachamim omrim ne'emanim. Even though they themselves are the one that are mekayim the signatures, they can't say anything to posel that shtar. Whereas that's what Rabbi Meir says. So they can't even say we were forced into it. Why? What happened to the idea of the whole point of the Mishnah, which is a pesha azar, a pesha yitir? The Chachamim said, well, of course they're believed. So now Bishlam l'Rabbanan Kitamayim, a pesha azar, a pesha yitir. How could Rebbe Meir disagree that even, in other words, there's no pesha azar? I mean, I understand. There may be, remember, there were a number of different cases over here. One of them was they were saying we were puzzled for testimony, not that we were people that steal money. We changed our mind on that. We were relatives. Okay, and the reason I won't believe them is because it's against the chazaka. The chazaka is that nobody has witnesses that he doesn't check up, that at least they should be kosher witnesses. I mean, what, is he crazy? So obviously, we didn't take the guy's children to be the witnesses, so that we can rely on the Malva. Same thing would be true about Ketanim. He took little kids to be his witnesses. You believe it, baby. That's Reb Shimon ben Lakish's general learning, which is the Amar Reish Lakish. Look, all around, nobody gets involved, not the people that get the Edim, not the Edim in signing. Nobody does anything so stupid as signing on something or getting people to sign on something which is done by little kids. Come on. And the same thing is true about the person who's going to have the Edim sign. But why does Rebbe Meir claim that they are not believed to say there was a gun to our head? Omer of Chista, because Rebbe Meir holds that Edim who have a gun to their head and are told, sign this or we kill you, should allow themselves to be killed and should not sign. What? Omar Le Rava, that's insane. What are you talking about? Well, obviously, of course, Rebbe Meir doesn't hold this. However, the Rishonim or Masber, this is an incredible halacha, that people believe that. People believe that integrity would demand of them not to sign just because it's they need to sign. And therefore, psychologically, they are saying something that is self-incriminating. Ain't other Mesim Atzma Russia. But he's not a Russia. That's what he's supposed to do. I know. But you don't really need the din of a Russia. You just need to say that a person cannot say something about himself that puts him down. That's the point. So you can't say something that makes you look bad. This makes you look bad. We don't hear from you anything that makes you look bad. And therefore, even though obviously that's okay to do, the court won't accept it. Omar Le Rava, that's crazy. I mean, they come to the same court, okay? And they ask the court, what do I do? The guy has a gun to my head. He wants me to sign a contract, which is a lie. Should I sign? What will we tell him? What do you think we'll tell him? Of course we'll tell him to sign. Well, obviously, we'll say to him, go right ahead. And now that they did what they would have been told to do, we're going to say to them, well, we don't believe you. You can't put yourself down. What? It's the same court. Why'd you sign? That wasn't nice. So therefore, we're going to have to find tomorrow a different approach on this. And we'll get into it in an analysis of the other approach, which opens up a whole new issue. So we won't start now. But meanwhile, we have examined the far limits of Peshas or Pesha Yitir in terms also of other psychological elements, other aiding elements, including Kivan Sheikin Shuvin Echazer Magid, including the Din of Modeh B'Miktzas and why that's not similar to the issues of a Pesha Asa, Pesha Yitir, including the questions of the analysis of what good a Shvua is in cases where there's a Chshad of a Shvua, and even talking about cases where it has nothing to do with collection, but has to do with the Nemanis per se, that is to say, the Edis per se, which also raised other elements of Edis, such as Pagin and Dibure, and in other Mesim Atzmai Rasha. And now, according to this new approach in Rebbe Meir, a person is not even Neman to say something that would make people look down at him. And even though it's obviously crazy, but why would we believe him to say that I signed checker? We don't hear those words, even though you were allowed to sign checker. Okay, amazing, amazing stuff. We'll continue with the good Lord's very great help and tremendous chasadim, which are completely chinam and have absolutely no reason to believe are based on any history of having previously experienced these amazing gifts. We still hope to be able to meet tomorrow and further experience. I shouldn't even say further, because that's like a violation of the whole issue of quantum mechanics and so on. And experience these new gifts tomorrow. Bezrat Hashem. See you all. Halavai. Kol tov. To be continued, we hope.